Welcome to episode 118 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
And I'm Gary Ferencik, general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPalms. Today is a great day for rivalries. If you're into American football, we've got the Army-Navy game that has great traditions. And if you're into real football, we've got England versus France in World Cup.
Looking forward to them both. On this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or POEMS. If you want all of them, subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus, where you get a POEM every day and a great primary care reference. You can check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can also get CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. Just go to IAFP.com and click on their online IAFP education webpage. This week, jaundice in babies, treating painful diabetic peripheral neuropathy, acetazolamide for patients hospitalized with CHF, and screening for CVD in older men. Kate.
Yeah, today I have the 2022 hyperbilirubinemia guideline from the American Academy of Pediatrics and our friend Steve Brown, who is a family medicine representative to the guideline group. So this guideline revises the guidelines from that the group last published in 2004, citing new evidence that the risk of kernicterus occurs at much higher thresholds than previously thought. The guideline focused on patient-oriented outcomes, so the development of kernicterus, and the risk of side effects with phototherapy, which are bigger than previously thought. It provides some new guidance to us. The guidelines are mainly based on expert consensus following interpretation of a technical report. Steve did mention when I chatted with him about it that there was kind of a paucity of evidence, which is in part because kernicterus is happily quite rare, especially among healthy infants, which is the majority of the population, babies in this group. The guideline development committee comprised a number of stakeholders, including not only Steve, but also patients. I guess their parents, really. Guideline group of infants would be fun. I'll give you a summary of key recommendations in a minute, but the biggest changes are there used to be 2 nomograms, which was very confusing to all of us, mostly including residents. One that determined phototherapy thresholds for treatment, and the other that we used all the time to determine follow-up interval after discharge. And there's now just 1 to determine phototherapy thresholds, which is a mercy because 2 nomograms was very confusing. So follow-up interval now depends on hours since birth and distance from that threshold of your bilirubin level. There's another article that looked at what they call that delta bilirubin level. So babies that are farther from the threshold can wait slightly longer to come in. So the farther you are, your number is below the threshold, the safer it is, essentially. The rule of thumb that babies younger than 48 hours of discharge need to be seen within 48 hours is still generally true because bilirubin levels tend to peak at about 96 hours of life. The threshold to start lights, the other big change is that the threshold to start lights has been shifted upwards overall. A podcast is not an ideal medium to describe a nomogram, but as an example, a 24-hour baby born at 40 weeks, the threshold for treatment is now 13.5 compared with the 11.5 it used to be. So in general, all of those thresholds are a little bit higher. So hopefully we'll be seeing fewer babies treated with phototherapy. And again, that has to do with the fact that we have more knowledge now about the thresholds for developing kernicterus and some of the negative effects associated with light therapy. Again, just a few highlights of some of the other recommendations that they have now made. They recommend, and this is somewhat of an important, transcutaneous bilirubin levels are now widespread in hospitals. They emphasize screening tests only. So any baby that you're tempted to start lights on should have that, all of those treatment decisions should be made based on serum bilirubin levels. All babies should be screened visually at least every 12 hours while they're in the hospital. Anyone who's noted to be jaundiced should have either a transcutaneous or a serum bilirubin level as a follow-up test. All babies should have a transcutaneous or serum bilirubin level between 24 and 48 hours after birth. And that includes babies who are born outside the hospital for whatever reason. If the transcutaneous bilirubin level is within 3 mg/dL of the phototherapy level, do a serum bilirubin. Again, just emphasizing those are screening tests. Those are not should not be used to make treatment decisions. they're great screening tests, but they're not particularly precise. And again, there are some harms associated with phototherapy. There are some others. I'm going to leave those in the script for folks to read. And then there are a number of other recommendations made about the treatment of infants who are, including, for example, a question that has long vexed us, which is when do we do a rebound level? And that that question has now, there's now a recommendation associated with it. So, Henry, what do you think?
Wow. Thank you, Steve, first of all, for your participation in this. You know, the last baby I delivered just graduated from medical school, so it's been a while. reaching back into the cobwebs of my memory, first of all, yeah, my recollection is that Kernicterus was almost exclusively in preemies with RH incompatibility and acidotic infants, and it was really quite rare in otherwise normal healthy newborns. So the rarity of Kernicterus, even in the pre-exchange transfusion and Rogam era, now that we're much more aggressive about providing good care and addressing the ABO, the RH incompatibilities, you know, that really does make a big difference. But there's also the potential for this post hoc ergo propter hoc reasoning, which is that we'll see the American Academy of Pediatrics because of our best guess estimates, we're seeing even less Kernicterus. So we have to be a little bit careful about drawing conclusions that the guideline is effective when, in fact, it may be many other factors. But this is a lot more reassuring that we'll have less phototherapy, that we can be much more reassuring. And I like the reinforcement that women who are breastfeeding their babies, we don't need to worry about supplementation and supplemental hydration.
Gary, don't worry. We won't ask for your opinion on this one.
I was going to say,
Professor
thank
of Medicine.
You. Have mercy on the internist.
Moving on. Let's go, Henry. Got the quiz.
All right. So staying on the theme of younglings, which of the following statements about the ages and stages questionnaire is true? A, it can only be administered by specially trained individuals. B, it only assesses cognitive development in children. C, it is highly accurate in detecting developmental delay when parents, teachers, or other caregivers have specific concerns. And D, when a score is one or two standard deviations below the mean, the ASQ is moderately accurate in detecting children with developmental, motor, cognitive, and language delays. Stay tuned.
I have no idea. Henry, tell us about decreasing pain in adults with diabetic peripheral neuropathy. Sounds important.
The common problem, I think, unfortunately. So this asks the question about whether amitriptyline, duloxetine, or pregabalin are effective in decreasing pain in adults with diabetic peripheral neuropathy. This was published in Lancet, I think about 6 weeks ago, by Tessa Fay and colleagues. This was a randomized crossover study, so there's a little bit of complexity in it. So they started off with 130 adults with diabetes and painful neuropathy for at least 3 months. I don't recall what the baseline pain threshold was at the start of the study. Now it's a complex design. So let me just describe a little bit what they did. So there were three different 16-week cycles, each separated by a 2-week washout period. So they could start with oral amitriptyline, and then depending on outcomes, they could supplement with pregabalin. They could start with pregabalin supplemented with amitriptyline, or they could start with duloxetine supplemented with pregabalin. So during the first 2 weeks of the active intervention, what they did was they just ramped up the initial medication as tolerated to the maximum dose. And then they were maintained for 6 weeks of monotherapy. At the end of that 8-week period, just like what we would do in clinical practice, if they had pain levels that were three or less on a scale of 1 to 10, they said, you're a responder and we're just going to keep you on that. If you didn't reach that, then they added their second medication and then maintained that for the remainder of that cycle. And then they did that washout period. So what did they find? Well, it turns out that with the monotherapy period, that the proportion of people who were considered responders was about the same, about a third in each group. So that means that the other two-thirds got supplemental therapies. And at the end of the 16-week cycle, it turns out that the combination therapy was also relatively equivalent. 40 to 48% were considered responders. So very similar degree of pain, regardless of which combination or where you started. There were some issues with regards to side effects being a little bit higher. So, for instance, if you start with duloxetine, you are more likely to have dizziness. If you start with pregabalin, more likely to have nausea. And if you start with amitriptyline, you are more likely to have dry mouth. So what basically this tells us is that we've got lots of options. Monotherapy, it's okay, but combination therapy is even better. Now, I think we recently did, maybe it's been a couple months ago, the American Academy of Neurology guideline on the treatment of neuropathy, and they recommended tricyclics, SNRIs, gabapentinoids, and then sodium channel blockers as first-line treatment. And they said that, you know, most of the time, it's not going to work all that well, and that we might need to do a series of individual trials, but it did not address combination therapy. And this is the first study that I've seen that tries to look at that. Mark.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was a little bit disappointed. None of them were more than 48% effective. None of the combinations. So that means more than half of people weren't responders with either combination. But when I add up the individual adverse event profiles for each one, they also, you know, it ends up being about 50% adverse effects for each combination. So I think really is a matter of, you know, keeping these three combinations in mind, starting with one kind of randomly based on cost maybe, and then going from there and seeing which of the three the patient tolerates the best and has the best benefit from. Okay.
Henry, do you happen to know what the average age was of the patients in this trial?
There were patients with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. About 3/4 of them had type 2. So largely, it was mixed, but largely an older population.
So I guess that's reassuring in some ways, because you think with a lot of these meds, you might be a little hesitant to combine duloxetine and pregabalin or amitriptyline and pregabalin, and folks as they get a little bit older. Just for safety reasons, but I guess it is almost reassuring. You know, my expectations of treating painful diabetic neuropathy aren't always that high. So knowing even that you can get to a response rate in the mid-40s is actually better than I was expecting. So I like it, and I do love the study design. I love a crossover trial. So
yeah.
So you're glass half full, and I'm glass half empty.
So I've got the deciding vote. I'm a glass half empty on this also. A couple of things. I think most of these people, this is polypharmacy. You're adding drug upon drug upon drug. These people are not just on these two drugs. They're on multiple medications almost always. That always concerns me. I agree with Mark. The side effect profile, if you look at it in the table that was in the handout for this, you know, is almost as high as the improvement table as well. And I got myself smart on this as well. When you talked about the sodium channel blockers, I thought, God, what the heck is a sodium channel blocker? So for those of you who are listening who, like me, didn't know that, these are really drugs that are mostly like carbamazepine, and they're like topiramate, and drugs like lamotrigine and the like. So I those weren't part of the study. So it'd be interesting to see if those have any added or perhaps differential benefit, because they were mentioned in the guideline that you had alluded to.
And I'm up next with a poem about acetazolamide. It's called Acetazolamide and Acute Decompensated Heart Failure with Volume Overload, New England Journal of Medicine. And it's I like this because it's a study of an older off-patent drug that doesn't cost $500 a month. So they randomized about 520 adults with acute decompensated heart failure to either IV acetazolamide, 500 milligrams daily for 3 days, or matching placebo. All patients also got standardized IV loop diuretic therapy, and they dosed it as double of their usual oral maintenance dose, which is something I was always taught to do back in the day. Anyone taking maintenance acetazolamide or SGLT2 inhibitors at the time of admission were excluded. The trial participants had a mean age of 78 years. Two-thirds were men. They were almost entirely white. This was a European study. Additionally, 87% were classified as NYHA class 3 or 4, which is moderate to severe heart failure. The primary outcome was successful decongestion, which was defined as the absence of signs of volume overload within 3 days of randomization without needing to escalate the decongestive therapy. Overall, significantly more patients in the acetazolamide group than in the placebo group achieved that primary outcome, 42 versus 30% NNT of 8. This was consistent across all of the subgroups. The benefit was smaller in patients who were admitted on a higher dose of maintenance diuretics, prior to admission, compared with those receiving a lower dose. The acetazolamide group also had a significantly shorter hospital stay, about 9 days instead of 10, so they got home a day earlier, and a higher incidence of successful decongestion at discharge, again, NNT of about 7. Adverse events were similar. There was no difference in deaths or rehospitalizations. So bottom line, for patients with chronic, moderate to severe heart failure who are hospitalized with acute volume overload, adding acetazolamide to IV loop diuretics does lead to faster decongestion, gets them home a little bit sooner. This study was started before SGLT2 inhibitors were well studied for the treatment of heart failure, and this was a predominantly white population. So this may not be generalizable to all populations, but still thought it was interesting. Gary?
Yeah, a couple of things. I don't think SGLT2s are useful for acute heart failure. They're certainly more in the chronic thing. But acetazolamide, a diamox, is also useful for altitude sickness. So anybody who's been skiing, for example, 10,000 feet or above, like myself, and I have taken it in the past, it is a powerful diuretic. I can't sit in one loop on the chairlift without having to get off and urinate. I agree with you, Mark. This, I still do a fair amount of hospital work and trying to diurese people who are coming in with this degree of heart failure. You're talking about class 2 or 3 with diuretics. Sometimes you're whacking their kidneys as well. It would be interesting to see if there was any higher incidence of kidney or renal insufficiency associated with acetazolamide versus matching placebo. It didn't look like there was, because I got out of the hospital earlier. I'm assuming there wasn't, but, I like this study. This is something I hadn't thought about. And quite frankly, having taken care of patients in the hospital who fall into this category of almost being refractory to, loop diuretics, this seems like a reasonable thing to actually, consider.
Yeah, they did say adverse events were similar in the groups, and there was no difference in renal adverse outcomes. So that's a good thing. Kate?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. I mean, I think there are a few things, like you said, that aren't totally generalizable. So they said shorter hospital stay, 9 versus 10 days. That's certainly not typical for our populations. And the other thing that I wonder about, so they said that one of the things that they were looking at was lack of need to escalate decongestion therapy. But I kind of wonder if it actually wouldn't be more useful to know, when you've got those folks who are already at their max tolerable doses of loop diuretics, does adding it, is that the place where it's more useful? Because I think clinically that's how we would actually be using it. So we'd sort of max out their Lasix. And then that's where we would be looking to sort of say, does adding acetazolamide, is that where it's helpful? Rather than saying, okay, well, we're going to put you on 40 BID of Lasix and then, see, does this get you out of the hospital faster when we're talking about like a 2 to 3 day hospital stay instead?
Yeah, although they did find that the benefit was smaller in the patients who came in on a higher dose of maintenance diuretics. So if anything, that group benefited a bit less, and it was those who were on lower dose, maybe 20 to 40 a day as outpatients, who benefited a bit more. We'll see.
Sorry. Okay, hi. Yeah, this is a study out of Denmark with the clinical question, does an intensive screening protocol for cardiovascular disease reduce cardiovascular events in older men, events or mortality? This was published in the New England Journal several months ago, and it's a randomized controlled trial of invitation to participate in a screening trial of 16,000 men in Denmark. About two-thirds of them accepted the invitation to be screened. Okay, so what was the screening protocol? So you had this cadre of about 10,000 men who accepted the invitation to be screened. And they were screened with multi-modalities. The biggest one, which I haven't quite heard of yet, was a non-contrast electrocardiographically gated CT scan, which seemed to have measured multiple things: coronary artery calcium, looking for aneurysms in the thoracic aorta, also was capable of detecting atrial fibrillation. They also looked for peripheral arterial disease with atrial index screening. They also checked their blood pressure, looking for hypertension and looking for hyperlipidemia and diabetes. So they had a multimodality, both radiographic as well as a lab test to look for patients who are at high risk. Once they were at high risk, they were then sent back to their primary care doc to say, okay, these are the results, you know, obviously make a patient-centered decision concerning this. So what they looked at then was looked at the invited and uninvited group. So they had two groups there, and they followed them up for 5.6 years. And long story short, without getting into a lot of the details in terms of what they actually found in terms of the number of patients who fell into each one of these categories, they actually found that there was a slight improvement in mortality, whether the patient had a pulse or not, in patients younger than the age of 70. So the NNT or the NN screening, the NNS basically was 91. Patients needed to be screened with this multi-modality intervention to prevent one death over 5 years. This was a number that was not seen in those over the age of 70. So there's a little bit of a discrepancy between, benefit in terms of the patient's age. And then when they looked at, a couple of other specific outcomes, and there weren't any huge differences between the two groups. And so what they ended up saying here is that, there's a small benefit in intensive screening in mostly white elderly men or less than age of 70 issues compared to elderly men in Denmark. There is something here. I mean, when I see an NNT of 91 over 5 years to prevent one death, that is not an unreasonable NNT or NN screening number. And the other important point that they make here is this is only a 5-year follow-up, right? So they have a plan on doing a reanalysis between the groups at 10 years or so. So extensive cardiovascular screening, although they gave a negative, negative review to this, didn't really seem to have an overall benefit. There seemed to be some modest benefits. And I think the story is yet to be fully told with regards to this.
Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you make some good points about the generalizability of the study. I also do have a lot of questions about exactly what the intervention was, about what that sort of holistic cardiac screening that they did. And then, like you said, it's a small benefit. I think that's typical for a lot of screening trials, that most people don't benefit from their preventive, thing. Like you said, an NNT of 91 over 5 years, roughly 500, per year. That's for cardiovascular disease, which is, common and deadly. And yeah, that if, we're not talking about, antibiotics for strep or anything here, it's a big number, but not unreasonable for a screening condition. So I think my bigger questions are more about, what exactly was that intervention, and would that be something, because those folks are just handed off to their primary care doctors then, to get those interventions. Are those things that we could then, say, okay, we can do that in the U.S. where we don't necessarily have those same interventions, or have that close and easy connection to primary care?
Yeah, one other quick sidebar is only about half of the people who screened positive actually had an intervention. So as you start looking at not just the screening, but what happened afterwards, it was still a smaller number. And so there was less uptakes for many interventional strategies amongst patients who screened positive for whatever reason. They couldn't follow that.
Henry, any final thoughts on this one?
Yeah, so there's so much in this study, and we could probably spend a whole podcast talking about it. So overall, this was kind of a negative-ish study, and you have to ask, is it big enough? Well, with 50,000 participants, 10,000 of whom got the intervention, I think it's big enough. Was it long enough? Well, for cardiovascular outcomes with lipids and things of that nature, at least in secondary prevention trials, I think we typically see reasonable event rates with regards to cardiovascular kinds of things. All-cause mortality may be a little bit different. I'm a little concerned that the subgroup, it's a narrow window. It's the group that's 65 to 70 that appeared to have the biggest biggest benefit. And, you know, so the big question in my mind is, who were these 50,000 people they invited? Were these people who had already been free from disease? Was this truly an unscreened, unafflicted population, or was it a mix? And so I think there's still a lot more to be said about this whole screening approach.
Sounds good. I think you're right. There's always more to be done on screening. And in this case, I think the health system differences and the sort of what we do at baseline for the unscreened people probably mitigated some of the potential benefit. Henry, you got a quiz answer for us?
Yeah. So the quiz asked, which of the following statements about the ages and stages questionnaire, the ASQ, is true? A, it can only be administered by specially trained individuals. B, it only assesses cognitive development in children. C, it's highly accurate in detecting developmental delay when parents, teachers, or other caregivers have specific concerns about the child. And D, when the score is one or two standard deviations below the mean, the ASQ is moderately accurate in detecting children with developmental, motor, cognitive, and language delays. So those were long, but I apologize for that. So the ASQ is a screening instrument, and it actually assesses a range of things, ranging from fine and gross motor tasks, problem-solving skills, communication, cognitive skills, and language. And it can actually be completed by the parents while they're sitting in the waiting room or in the exam room. And it can also be administered by anyone, like teachers and caregivers who spend a lot of time with a specific child. We had a recent systematic review that identified 43 studies that were of kind of middling quality, evaluating how accurate this was. And it turns out it was moderately accurate, with an area under the receiver operating characteristic curve of about 3/4, so modest, regardless of whether you use one or two standard deviations below the mean as your threshold for referral. There was a large number of reference standards, so they didn't pool the data. But what they found was that the positive likelihood ratios ranged anywhere from about 2 to 6.5, and the negative likelihood ratios from about 0.2 to 0.7. So decent to modest at best. And so generally it wasn't all that reliable. So if you've got a parent who had, or a caregiver or a teacher who has got specific concerns about a child, you probably need to do additional evaluation and referral. So the correct answer in this case was D.
All right. Thank you, Henry. Thanks to everybody else for listening. And thanks to you guys for showing up on a Saturday morning to do this podcast. this is, again, if you want to get CME credit, IFP.com, go to their online IFP education webpage. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion of our four poems. Tell your friends about our podcast, Primary Care Update. We'll talk to you soon with more Primary Care Updates.